Welcome to the Freedom Report.
What I love about Austin Peterson is his love of the battle. He wants to fight.
Austin was, of course, the rabble-rouser, just to make sure I stayed Rothbardian.
We live in a world fraught with danger, and there is a certain amount of danger that the public must endure in order to secure the blessings of liberty.
For economic freedom and personal liberty. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Austin Peterson here, producer of the Freedom Report podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today is Thursday, December the 13th, and I'm really delighted to have the opportunity to speak to a special guest who's joining me today. His name is Bob Zadik. He is a practicing attorney out of California. He hosts a libertarian talk radio show. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Austin. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely delighted to have you here, Bob. Thank you so much. And I was really excited to have you volunteer to step up on my to do this podcast, because you were a little bit triggered, is that fair to say, by an article that came out on the Libertarian Republic. It was called Five Reasons Libertarians Will Never Win an Election. You contacted me and you're like, hey, we need to discuss this. So thanks for coming on to talk about this, Bob.
And of course, it's a little, the issue of libertarians winning elections is really, it has to be divided into two sub-issues. Number one, libertarians, small L, that is those, forget about party affiliation, but their heart and soul is libertarian, and those who run with the capital L libertarian label, those are two quite different conversations.
Mm-hmm. Well, during my U.S. Senate campaign, which you were a big supporter of, thank you, by the way, I ran as a libertarian Republican, at least towards the beginning of my campaign. And towards the end of my campaign, I realized that this was a name that turned people off, because so many people don't know the difference between capital L party member libertarians and small L philosophical libertarians. So I found myself calling myself a constitutional conservative, because I think that is a little bit closer to what people, in, at least in the Republican Party, feel more comfortable with in terms of labeling. But let's just go through this. Let's just go through this list, because I want to have you address each of these points, Bob, and give me your opinion. See, the number one big problem that libertarians face is the fact that we have districting that's really not conducive to third parties, right? Republicans and Democrats accuse each other of gerrymandering, but we don't get to even complain, right? In a sense, like, we don't even have an opportunity to gerrymander, because we don't have anyone who's elected into office, so there are no libertarians elected in office, at least capital L libertarians. So it's not as if the Libertarian Party will maybe ever get to take advantage of that tool to their own, to their, for their own ends or devices. But do you see as districting, or specifically gerrymandering, being a big problem for libertarians?
Not gerrymandering, because libertarians, first of all, libertarians are not located in any particular area. In fact, Republicans are libertarians. They just don't know it. Democrats are libertarians. They just don't know it. And registration rolls don't indicate how people feel about issues. It indicates how they chose to register, that is, give public information. So gerrymandering is absolutely unimportant in terms of any third party, specifically libertarians. Mm-hmm. What is important is the infrastructure of politics and democracy is so biased against third parties, not by accident, of course, that if a business had done what either of the two major political parties have done, there would be antitrust litigation and they would lose it. So what they have been able to get away with by monopolizing the marketplace for ideas would be criminal if they were doing the same thing selling sofas or cell phones. And it's pretty bizarre that we, as a country, that we have so little respect for diversity of ideas that we don't care about antitrust violations in ideas, we do care about antitrust violations with cell phones. It's pretty bizarre that we devalue ideas as much as we do, and therefore denying the public access to a wider range of ideas. And that's part of the political sickness in our country right now.
But so here's a small question for you that should be lead to a follow-up here. Did you follow the campaign of the New York gubernatorial candidate Larry Sharp this last year?
Larry was on my show. I loved the guy. Mm-hmm. I supported him. Yes, I followed his campaign, but it was a challenge to follow it because he couldn't get traction, because he couldn't get any attention. Not because he wasn't deserving of an attention, but it's like if you have a new food product and try to get space on the Safeway shelf or Kroger shelf, you can't do it. So it's almost impossible to get into the game.
Right. Well, the reason why I brought it up is because he polled very well. I mean, for a libertarian, he was polling well, and he fundraised very well. And yet he fell slightly below the Green Party candidate, Howie Hawkins, despite those facts that he fundraised better. He polled better leading up to the election. I mean, don't you think that that's sort of a temperature check for where the electorate's at right now?
No, because in New York, look, it's New York. New York is an uber progressive state, and progressive and green are the same thing. So therefore, progressives, even though if they were to do idea by idea, they would find more of an affinity with Larry Sharp's principles, that a larger number of ideas they'd be in agreement with than either Democrat, Republican, or Green. But voters, as you know, voters use what Ilya Solomon calls voting shortcuts. People don't have time, nor should they really spend time, that's another subject, in studying issues. Therefore, if you're going to vote and exercise what you call to be a civic duty, it's not a civic duty, but it's called that, then and you don't have time, you rely upon shortcuts. And you pick other people or other signals that tell you how to vote, because you don't have the time to study. And Green is a very appealing voter shortcut. Mm-hmm. And people just gravitate towards the Green. It's like, you know, it's like when you throw paper in the recycling bin, you kind of feel good. Well, that vacuous kind of feeling good with no substance is the same principle that gets people to vote for, like, the Green Party.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So another big issue for especially for me in my senatorial campaign this last year was the issue of immigration. And one of the bullet points that I was talking about is why I believe that the Libertarian Party won't really fit into 2020. Because it's not 2016, right? It's not going to be the year of Never Trump in 2020 because we already have President Trump. And my argument is that the Democrats are going to run a candidate to the left to fight populism with populism. Essentially, even Hillary Clinton and John Kerry both recently voiced a sentiment that, you know, that mass migration into Europe was problematic. Now, when the Democrats hear that, the ones who are the populist Democrats or maybe the libertarian left Democrats are going to go deeper into their Democratic field to find someone that they can have run against whoever the establishment Democrat will be. Now, here's the thing. Most Americans do not agree with libertarians on immigration. I mean, that's documented. Very, 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 very few people agree with many of the libertarian views when it comes to immigration. So if we have, let's say, Bill Weld as the Libertarian Party's nominee in 2020, there's only one way that they can run to the they have to run to the left of President Trump, because you can't run to the right of President Trump on regulations or taxes or anything like that, because even if you don't like, you know, the tax bill, even if you don't think he could have gone farther on regulations, the fact is that he's shown a willingness to make those kinds of cuts. So why, you know, what place can the libertarians run in? Where do they fit in? And how can they distinguish themselves from Trump, being that the one issue that they can distinguish themselves is something the majority of Americans disagree with?
Oh, that's kind of an easy question, at least for me, Austin. The way for libertarians, indeed any candidate, to distinguish themselves is to approach the subject of immigration with fact-based positions, data-based positions, not hyperbole and emotion. Neither party relies upon fact and data. They rely upon emotion. They play to the lowest level of their audience when they are campaigning. And in fact, a sensible, fair-minded, data-driven approach to immigration. And by the way, libertarians are not – immigration is an issue where there is lots of wiggle room among libertarians, where libertarians will vary quite a bit within a range on immigration. So immigration isn't like the ideal litmus test, are you a libertarian kind of issue, because there's a lot of room for divergent points of view within the libertarian movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the big problems that I've identified that libertarians suffer from is a lack of empathy, and how this translates into poor marketing. So we sort of struggle with practicality, right? You know, and we frequently lash out at people that disagree with this, calling them, you know, statist bootlicking sheeples. And I'm no stranger to libertarians placing words in my mouth just to have something to complain about on the internet. But here's the thing, Bob. You know, small, medium businesses, they employ the majority of Americans. If I had won the Libertarian presidential nomination in 2016, my top priority would have been to make the Libertarian Party the party of small business, right? Because those are the people who would benefit the most from our ideas. So, in my opinion, if the people who stand to benefit the most from our ideas are turning us down, I think we're doing something very wrong. What is your comment on that?
Well, I'm not so sure. If the people who are turning us down are small business men and women, is that the mark or the demographic we're talking about?
Correct.
Well, nobody is, you know, labels are really hazardous because everybody wears so many labels. You could assign 15 hyphenated labels to your own life. And so could I. So when you're a businessman, you're also probably have a family. You also are a male. You may be middle-aged. You may be old. You may be young. You may live in the suburbs. You may live in the city. All of those give you a different demographic label. And what you are saying with your question is that business people, like any other person who have 15 different labels and 15 different sets of principles, depending upon which label they're using at the minute, they didn't find being a business person to be the dominant label. There were other things that crowded it out. Maybe they were of a religious group, and therefore that drove their vote. Maybe they have strong feelings on abortion, and their feeling, the intensity of their feelings on abortion was greater than the intensity they feel as a business person. Or they might feel that abortion can be solved politically, but not their problems being in business. So it's a very complex question. And when you take one characteristic, a business person, and expect everybody to vote solely for that reason, people are too complex and their lives are too complex.
Mm, good. Yeah, really interesting. So one of the problems that I noticed during my 2016 campaign before I switched and became a Republican is that, in my opinion, the Libertarian Party is being overrun by leftists, right? And during the 2016 presidential campaign, Bernie Sanders had lost the nomination to Hillary, and the Gary Johnsonites spent a lot of time bringing in a lot of these leftists, and now there's a Libertarian Socialist Caucus in the party, and, you know, Gary Johnson, when he was asked to define libertarianism, he said libertarianism is socially liberal and fiscally conservative. Well, here's the thing. That defines me personally, but in my opinion, that doesn't define libertarianism as a whole, because I always believed it's perfectly acceptable to be socially conservative as long as you don't want to use the government to force those views on someone else. Do you think Gary made a mistake by characterizing libertarianism that way?
I do, because, look, I live in my head, Austin, and I don't do well with glib four-word descriptions of anything as complex as describing libertarianism. It doesn't get anywhere. And what I do when I try to explain being a libertarian, what it means to me and why I am one, the best way to do it is by asking whoever I'm talking to, pick an issue and let's compare viewpoints. And you, Mr. or Ms. Audience, will find that you are really in agreement with me on most issues. So forget the label. And, you know, Austin, that's another point in politics is I never ask anybody on any issue how you feel about an issue or how you feel about party affiliation. It's boring to me. I ask people, why do you feel that way? If you drill down from the answer and get to the thought process, that's where the conversation is more interesting, it's more cerebral, and people then understand why somebody feels the way, I don't care. It could be random. It could be they tossed a coin. Tell me why you feel the way you do about immigration, and let's see where the common ground is. So a label is always hazardous, never very productive, and in a conversation, frankly, pretty boring. I like to know the whys, not the conclusion.
Okay. Well, one of the problems that I saw was the rise of the Libertarian Socialist Caucus within the LP. The Libertarian Socialist Caucus has come in and is trying to make fundamental changes to the Libertarian Party's platform. The Libertarian Party had a convention in New Orleans this last year, and in it they actually had some difficulty, although they did ultimately prevail, in passing a platform plank affirming that the Libertarian Party only supports economic systems that rely on voluntarism and not on coercion. The Libertarian Socialist Caucus obviously opposed this heavily, but they did have a problem trying to pass just a basic affirmation of libertarian principles. Do you think that's a problem?
You know, it's kind of, of course it's a, well, it's a problem in this regard, that if you drill down to libertarian principles, libertarianism as such is not an economic system. Libertarianism is very basic. It describes an individual's relationship to his or her government. And there is nothing in the Constitution, nothing in the Bill of Rights, very much, that it describes even remotely an economic system. And you will find nothing. The founders didn't design an economic system. They designed a political system, specifically somebody's relationship to their government. And that is, in a word, it's liberty. And once you have liberty as the core, the economic system takes care of itself. And to the extent that any system, and by the way, the socialist label doesn't, no one who is today a socialist is a socialist. They just want free stuff. So socialism is a catch-all phrase for free stuff. Somebody else pays. It's not socialism. Even the most avowed socialist is not in favor at all of government ownership of the means of production. So nobody even knows what socialism is. And if they did, they wouldn't support it. Yeah. So socialism is kind of a really distracting word that has lost all meaning in intelligent conversation.
Just FYI, the dictionary definition of socialism, for those who are listening who would like to know, the dictionary definition is central planning, central control of the means of production. So the idea behind socialism...
Yeah. That's fascism. Central control is fascism. Mm-hmm. Socialism in the Marxian concept, in that concept, is government owns all the means of production. fascism, Mussolini, is government doesn't own it, but it controls it through legislation. So it allows private people to own private property, but government says what you can and cannot do with the means of production. Mm-hmm. We have fascism in this company, in this country, in one particular industry, and that's banking. In banking, banks are privately owned, but they exist often to promote governmental policies. And so banks are as close as we come in this country to dipping our toe into fascism, but not socialism, because the government doesn't own the banks. They just run them.
Yeah, it's sort of crony capitalism is another word that we like to use, very, very closely related to fascism. Now, the libertarianrepublic.com is my website. That's where people, if you're listening right now, if you'd like to read that story and learn a little bit more about where I got these ideas from, you can go to 5 reasons why libertarians will never win an election. Now, the final point that I have here to discuss with you is the question, a big question that's really going to trigger a lot of libertarians for sure, is that in my opinion, Bob, while the non-aggression principle is a good general rule, basic rule, my belief is that it's got too many flaws, right? So because there is so much debate around the non-aggression principle, because it means so many different things to different people, my opinion is that that should preclude it from being a pledge, because why a pledge should be something that means the same thing to the people who all pledge it, right? We pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. That's a singular concept. But because we have a debate, I mean, the question is, does abortion violate the NAP, right? It depends on which libertarian you ask. You know, does allowing a child to starve to death violate the NAP, right? That depends on which libertarian you ask. What about if you get behind the wheel, if you're blackout drunk and you're swerving in and out of traffic? Is being a clear and present danger a violation to the NAP? Do you think that it's problematic that people have to pledge to something that everybody has a different definition of?
No, not at all. I think to find it problematic is to stifle people's thinking. There are lots of issues that no matter what the core belief system is, there is always going to be disagreement within the system, even in organized religion. Judaism, Christianity, people can disagree on how you apply principles. Even though you agree on the principles, the application, when you drill down, there can be disagreement. That's what makes intellectual life so interesting. The non-aggression principle must remain the core. And the fact that people can disagree, agree that non-aggression is a good core concept, but disagree on the application, does not weaken the principle. Not at all. Look, we all favor democracy as a concept. People should be able to participate in the decisions made by their government. But there can easily be, as I have written about, too much democracy. Any country will fail with too much democracy, and it might fail with too little democracy. But within that, there's a wide range in the middle. Disagreement is healthy. It encourages people to think. And the fact that people can disagree within a range doesn't mean the core principle is bad. So, no, I don't agree at all. The non-aggression principle, when explained, absolutely must remain as a core concept in the hearts and minds of libertarians.
Yeah, I think I disagree. And the reason why I disagree is multitudinous. However, I just happen to believe that because it is such a bland, generic concept, it's something that's so open to interpretation that it's too much of a problem to require people to pledge to something because it's so easy. You can, of course, you can pledge to not initiate forms of violence. But the problem is that when you do something like that, you know, in essence, my argument has always been that the non-aggression principle necessarily leads to what I call pacifist anarchism. Because aggression itself is something that is difficult to define, right? If I point a gun at you, if the gun's not loaded, is that an act of aggression? Well, maybe not, but it is an act that could get you killed justifiably, right? Now, you didn't have any chance to actually harm me with that rifle, and yet I saw it as what I determined a credible threat, so I will initiate force against you, and I believe that the initiation of force is on the, in essence, the supposed defender in defending themselves. And then I would apply that again to drunk driving, right? Where if you look at drunk driving, yes, maybe you can get all the way home and there was no victim, perhaps, right? But was there a crime that was committed? Is a clear and present danger a crime? These are big questions and the kinds of things that would take so much longer for us to delve into in the minutia. But I want to get to the main topic of the podcast for us to close this out in the last 5 minutes here, Bob. I want to talk about the ghosts of liberty's past, present, and future, and how we can sort of apply the history, the current history of the libertarian movement, and what we might see in the future. So, in terms of the ghost of Christmas past, I want to look at the movement. We had what was supposed to be a libertarian moment. If you remember, the New York Times published an op-ed several years ago saying that the rise of Rand Paul could be a libertarian moment, and yet here in Christmas future, Bob, we don't see a libertarian moment. We see a Trump moment. We see a MAGA moment. We don't even have a Tea Party anymore. So why do you think that the libertarian moment and the ghost of Christmas past, why do you think that that faded away?
Well, let me, in the margins, only in the margins, disagree a bit. And remember, I am burdened with profound optimism. It's the albatross I have to care. So driven by that optimism, here's my response. Libertarian moment as a political movement did pass, if it ever existed, for the minute, as a dynamic, as a governing consideration in the Republican Party. It never really was in the Democratic Party. But forget the political movement of libertarianism. Look at what's happened in the past few years. The states have legalized drug use in 32 states and counting, even though it is a federal crime. That is libertarianism, a principle in libertarianism, taking control of the states despite the fact that it's a felony at the federal level. Look at what's happening with immigration in sanctuary cities. As a country, if our leader speaks for us, as Trump speaks for us, he abhors litigation and he despises immigrants. The states, many states, sanctuary cities, sanctuary states, are adopting a libertarian view towards immigration despite the federal stated policy. Take drug use. Drugs are being legalized all around the country as libertarians believe they ought to be, despite federal law opposing it. So over and over and over again, the people, because the people have more to say in state and local politics than in national politics, the people are becoming more and more libertarian, even though established political parties may not be. So I don't bemoan the loss of the libertarian moment, because I am delighted at all of the current progress we are making on big issues. Mm-hmm. So I don't share your pessimism one tiny bit. I just say the libertarian movement is progressing in a different form, not by getting voting control of the House of Representatives, but by affecting the legislation that governs our lives at the state and local level.
All right. Well, I would say we would cover the ghost of Christmas present, but you've already done so to a degree. So here's the thing. I guess let's talk about the ghost of Christmas future. Let's talk about what the future of the liberty movement could be. In your opinion, Bob, what are the biggest, brightest lights of hope that you see coming for potential victories in the future?
Well, immigrants are a natural constituency. and we are approaching a point in our demographics when in the very, very near future, the white characteristics, those who are white as we understand it in a daily usage, will be in a statistical minority. And that more diversity speaks well, because with diversity we will have understanding. And I find that immigrants really are drawn to our country because of the freedom, not because of welfare benefits. We are still, for the rest of the world, the shining city on the hill that the pilgrims hoped they would find, that Reagan rekindled in us. And people move here for the freedom. And if they come here for the freedom, they will respect the freedom more and be more aggressive in trying to preserve it.
But sorry to cut you off, but that is not what the conservatives argue. They argue that immigrants come here to take welfare benefits. They argue and they have charts that they post with pictures of Stefan Molyneux on them that says, these immigrants, they come from Central America and they take our welfare benefits far more than others. They're just going to move here and vote for Democrats. And when you look at Texas, for example, and you look at the border, you know, the borderlands where they, you know, where you would think some immigrants would be coming across, they do tend to vote Democrat on that side. What are your thoughts on that?
They vote Democrats because the Republican Party said, we don't want you. That was a conscious decision made, a political miscalculation. Still goes back to Pete Wilson in California in 1996. Pete Wilson publicly announced through a proposition he encouraged in California in 1996, we are not interested in you, Mr. and Ms. Central and South and Mexican immigrant. We are not interested in you. Go away. Republicans made a conscious decision. You are not welcome here. Immigrants are a natural conservative Republican constituency that they reject. They, the Republicans, rejected. A grievous political error that will haunt the Republican for a very long time, until we have enlightened Republican leadership.
Now, Bob, I know you've got your own podcast as well, and you'd like to promote that. Would you mind telling us how people, if they want to listen to you and hear your thoughts and words some more, how can people hear your podcast and find out more about you?
My show, I've been doing a podcast for about 10 years. I published 2 books, transcripts of my podcast. I broadcast live on AM radio and live streamed on the web, 8 a.m. Pacific time, Sunday mornings. I'm sure you have nothing else to do Sunday mornings. You can listen live. If not, you can subscribe to my podcast on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. I have about 550 shows just sitting there waiting to be listened to. I also have 2 books available on Kindle and on Amazon. On Kindle, it's pretty costly. It's free. On Amazon, you got to drop $3 to buy the hardcover book. On Kindle, you get the digital version for free. It's an easy read. You'll like it. And to read my books is to know what I believe.
Fantastic. Bob Zadig from California. Bob, I heard they're going to start taxing your text messages, or they're trying to do so out there. You better watch out, brother.
No, I have an exemption, Austin, because I'm a libertarian. They gave me a waiver.
Okay, good to hear. Bob Zadig, thank you so much for coming on the show. Hope you have a happy holiday season. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning into the Freedom Report podcast. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Don't forget, you can always listen to the Freedom Report podcast on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, or any of the major podcasting channels. You can download us twice a week, the Freedom Report podcast, which is housed at thelibertarianrepublic.com, fighting for economic freedom and personal liberty.